Life, Sometimes It Washes Over Me by Kyu Ketsuki Rui. Rated Adult. Warnings: contains material that some may find disturbing and or triggering. It's hot today. Must be in the 90s, maybe, and it's not even noon yet. John's got his shirt off, got it tucked into the back of his cutoffs in case he needs it later. Doesn't want to have to go back to the motel room and risk waking Rodney. John should still be asleep himself. He doesn't remember what time he finally got in, but it was getting light outside. Couldn't get to sleep, though. Not that that's anything new, but he usually manages a couple hours. He'd tried. He'd lain in bed for 3 hours, at least, but he's got a tooth in back that's real bad, and lately even the usual aspirin and a joint treatment doesn't do much. It doesn't help any that his ass was fucked raw, either. That last guy'd been more than a little rough. Paid extra for taking John with nothing but a gob of spit. But John's kinda wishing now he'd said no. Still, $10 extra's nothing to sneeze at. Maybe they'll go see Return of the Jedi again tonight. It's only 4 blocks to the Winchells, and he's already sweating. The place is empty, except for a bum at one of the corner tables. And John goes straight for the cigarette machine, digging in his pocket for change. The usual, he tells Maria as he feeds quarters into the machine, and by the time he's up at the counter, she's got him all rung up. 2 chocolate glazed, a raspberry jelly, an eclair, 3 bear claws, and a large coffee. There's a little carton of milk, too, but the total's still the same. He pushes a crumpled 5 across the counter. What's that for? The cash register opens with a ding, and she counts out his change. A growing boy needs more than coffee and cigarettes. I'm 18, he says, smiling. And I'm still 25. She puts the carton in the bag with his donuts, carefully rearranging them so they don't get squashed. Just drink it, mijo, okay? He ducks his head and mumbles, thanks. He jams his change into his pocket, grabs the coffee too quickly, and some of it sloshes onto his hand. Not that hot, but for some reason his eyes are stinging anyway. He's halfway back home before he realizes he forgot to get any sugars. It's not that bad if he holds his breath when he drinks it. Not like he's drinking for the taste anyway. He cuts through the cemetery, sticks his coffee through a hole in the fence, and then pulls himself over the top. He sits Indian style on a bench in the shade, the stone still nice and cool. He eats the donuts as fast as he can shove them in his mouth and washes them down with the milk and the rest of the coffee. His tooth is fucking killing him. He can never remember to eat just on one side of his mouth. He punches himself on the jaw. Eat on the left, retard. It's not like he could go to the dentist, even if he wanted to blow all their savings. It'd be their ticket right out of L.A. and back into fucking foster care. A little sore tooth's nothing he can't deal with. He gets up then and trudges out the other side of the cemetery, kicking the balled-up donut bag ahead of him, and squinting so hard he can feel the start of a headache. Rodney is probably still sleeping. Seems like he always is. Lucky bastard never has trouble getting to sleep, not even in heat like this. Their room's gotta be sweltering. No breeze ever seems to come through the window, and the cheapo fan just blows hot air around. Course, once John gets to sleep, he stays asleep, never dreams much that he can remember. So that's a trade-off. At least there's a bit of a breeze now, so maybe he's better off not cooped up inside. He starts running after a bit, still kicking the bag until it goes wild, shooting out into the street, and then he just leaves it. There's no traffic. He could get it easily. But he's picking up speed now, his shirt flapping behind him. He grabs it and tugs it out of his shorts before it comes loose on its own, and he loses it. The only time he slows is when he turns the corner, and even so, he narrowly misses a collision with a stroller. The woman pushing it frowns at him, but he just grins and yells sorry over his shoulder, halfway down the block already. He shoots past the bus stop, flies off the curb without checking for cars, just a side street anyway. His feet are killing him. These sneakers have been too tight for months, and he's been meaning to pass them down to Rodney. They're still good enough. It's just his feet won't stop growing. Maybe tomorrow he'll go down to the Salvation Army again and see what they've got. He keeps hoping for a pair of Vans, those black and white checked ones. He wants them bad enough to maybe break down and buy them new. He can't remember ever having a pair of brand new shoes. When he finally slows to a walk, the sweat starts pouring off him, like all the sweat the wind blew dry is back and trying to drown him. He mops his face with his shirt and looks around. He's past Save-On. Any thoughts of picking up a pair of cheap sunglasses run clean out of his head, literally. He doesn't feel like turning back now. Not when he can see Shaky's just up the block, and his stomach's growling and his hands are suddenly itching to get a hold of a joystick. He could use a piss, too. He waits for a break in the cars and dashes across the street, pulling his shirt on over his head as soon as he's back on the sidewalk. It's cool and dark inside, nearly empty in that afternoon lull between the lunch and dinner crowds. He feels a bit bad at splurging on a whole medium pizza for himself, but what Rodney doesn't know won't hurt him. And more importantly, what Rodney doesn't know, he can't complain about. With that in mind, he orders a pitcher of root beer, too. He uses the bathroom while he waits, and it's always kind of weird now using a public restroom to actually piss. But it's the middle of the day, and it's mostly moms and kids here beside him, so it's not like hanging out in the bathroom to get him any money. He scarfs down half the pizza, then gets change for a five. That's all he's going to spend on games today. Maybe not even that if he's good enough. He keeps those quarters in his right pocket, separate from the rest of his money, so he's not tempted. There's a kid playing Crystal Castles already. It's always that way with the new games. John plays Ms. Pac-Man and Dig Dug instead, and then Tron for a bit, until the kid's mom finally comes and drags him away. It's nothing but Crystal Castles after that, with a few trips back to his table for another slice of pizza, at least until John's quarters run out. The pizza's run out by then, too, and the last of the root beer is watered down with melted ice. He drinks it anyway. Between his feet and his tooth and his ass, he's feeling pretty damn beat up. Tired, too, finally. Fat lot of good it does to him now when he's got to be awake for a good 12 hours or more. He shouldn't have spent all that money today. Rodney'll be pissed off. His feet hurt too bad to walk home, much less run, but the bus only goes halfway. It's nice while it lasts. He manages to snag a seat by an open window, presses his cheek to the glass and closes his eyes, enjoying the breeze. There are bums who ride the bus to the end of the line and back all day long. And maybe John will try that too, sometime, just to see where it goes. He ends up running the rest of the way home after all. It hurts more, but it's faster. Rodney's still asleep when John lets himself in. The little clock on the nightstand says 3:30, which John figures is about right even though it said 3:30 when he left this morning. It's close enough anyway. He turns on the fan. It's a fucking oven in here, no doubt. Rodney's hair is sticking to his forehead and cheek, his t-shirt dark with sweat, and he's tangled up in the sheets like a mummy. John wonders if that's just the heat, or if Rodney's had nightmares again, and now he's kicking himself for going off and leaving him alone. He toes out of his shoes, pulls his socks off, the right one bloody at the heel, and pads into the bathroom. He'll have to take a shower before going out again later, but that can wait. For now he just takes a piss and gets a drink from the tap. He has to let the water run for a bit before it stops coming out rusty. He strips down to his underwear and climbs onto the bed. "Hey," he whispers. "Hey, it's just me, okay?" The bed creaks and Rodney rolls over, mumbling something John can't hear. John stretches out, trying not to startle him. He lies still, barely breathing, and it's like trying to get a bird to hop into your hand or something. Just gotta wait and let them come to you. So John waits and watches Rodney toss and turn, listens to the snatches of nonsense and the bits he understands all too well, and eventually Rodney recognizes him, even in his sleep, and he curls around John, tangled sheets and all. It's hot and uncomfortable, and John probably won't have any better luck getting to sleep now than he did this morning, but it calms Rodney down, and that's something. The first time John met Rodney, he was a sullen little girl named Meredith. It was about the seventh or eighth time John landed in foster care, but his first time with the Allens. They had two older boys of their own, high school aged, and four foster kids, not counting John. Most of them were younger, the littlest not even in school yet. Meredith was the closest to his age, the same fifth grade class, but a year younger. He'd never known anyone who skipped a grade before. She had a funny slanted mouth that always made her look unhappy, and just about the shortest hair John had ever seen on a girl, the bangs uneven, like maybe she cut them herself. She played the piano a lot, and she didn't like football, but she liked Chips and the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman, and knew more about comics than John, so they got along well enough. When Star Wars was released that summer, Greg and Martha Allen took them all to see it, but Meredith was the only one who really got it like John did. They played Star Wars every day after that, fighting over who got to be Luke until they finally agreed to switch off every other day. It wasn't that Han wasn't cool, too, but he didn't have Jedi powers or a lightsaber, so it just wasn't the same. The one time John suggested Meredith be Princess Leia, she kicked him in the nuts so hard he cried, and wouldn't talk to him for the rest of the day. It wasn't long after that John's mom showed up again, new boyfriend in tow. This one was a mean drunk, and by the time he left her, John had what felt like permanent bruises on his arms, and spent the hottest weeks of summer sweltering in long sleeves and jeans. The fight after that was the worst. It started off the same as always. "If you just behaved yourself, Dale wouldn't have left." John just turned the sound up higher and pretended like The Love Boat was the most interesting show ever, even though it was dumb and a repeat anyway. He let her yell. Not like he hadn't heard it all before, and she'd leave him alone soon enough. He figured she'd be drowning her sorrows before the next commercial. Instead, she grabbed his arms, fingers wrapping right around the bruises Dale left, and shook him hard. "You're nothing but trouble." She was crying pretty hard, and Jordan would have felt bad if Dale hadn't been such an asshole. "I should have left you at the home." It stung more than it should have. She didn't mean it any more than he did when he snapped, "I wish you had." Her slap hurt more than anything Dale or any other stupid boyfriend ever did, but she hugged him after, like she hadn't done in years, and in the morning she took him to International House of Pancakes and let him order anything he wanted. He was back at the Allens before school started. Meredith wouldn't talk to him at all at first. She didn't even say hi when the social worker dropped John off, just went back to the piano and started playing as if he wasn't even there. "Don't let her fool you," Martha said when they were upstairs getting John settled. He didn't have a lot, just his backpack and a small suitcase he hadn't even gotten around to unpacking at home yet. If it weren't for Martha folding and putting away his clothes, he probably wouldn't bother here either. She kept peeking out the window ever since we got the call this morning. She pushed his suitcase under the bed and turned back to him. "Meredith's been with us a little over 3 years now, you know, and she's never really made friends." Martha said it like she was telling him some big secret, but John wasn't at all surprised. Meredith scowled at him all through dinner, and it was only after a week of the silent treatment that she came into his room one afternoon and said, "I'm going to play $6 Million Man. You can be Jamie Summers if you want." Like nothing ever happened. "I'm not a girl." "Be a boy named Jamie then, duh." Being bionic mostly involved running around the backyard or sitting in the narrow space between the garage and the back wall, which Meredith had declared their secret headquarters. It wasn't really all that secret, but it was the closest thing they had, and in the late afternoon like this, it was nice and shady. John wished the Allens had a treehouse, or a fort, or something. That would be cool. They sat with their backs against the garage and their legs propped up on the brick wall. Their knees were green from the grass. Meredith said, "I hope we're in the same class again this year." John hoped so too, but he just said, "I hope the school burns down and that we don't have to go at all." "I'm really a boy, you know." He looked at her out of the corner of his eye. It wasn't hard to imagine. Maybe if her name was Jamie, he would have thought she was a boy Jamie. She said, "There was an accident when I was born, and I came out with a girl body instead, that's all." John was way past the age when he believed in Santa or magic or stupid stuff like that. But the way she said it, in that same old bossy know-it-all voice, made it sound real somehow, like maybe it was just some disease or something he didn't know about. After all, he never knew anyone allergic to oranges and lemons before either. "That sucks," he said finally. "Yeah." Meredith scrambled to her feet. "I'm going to go see if there are any otter pups left. Gretchen better not have eaten the last one." They weren't in the same class. There were a few kids John remembered from fifth grade, and he made friends easily enough. He always had. Meredith declared everyone in her class stupid, and said she wouldn't want to be friends with them anyway. Christmas came and went, and John didn't hear a word from his mom. He turned 12 in January, and Martha baked a cake just like she had for Travis's birthday in November. The Allens treated him and the other foster kids like their own, which was more than he could say for a lot of the folks he stayed with. Sure, Travis got a new bike, and John got an X-Wing, but no one else had ever even asked when his birthday was. Sometimes his mom even needed reminding. That's probably why she didn't call or come get him or anything. He tried not to worry about her, tried not to think about how maybe, if John wasn't there, she might be the one getting hit. But maybe without a stupid kid around, she'd found a boyfriend who treated her good. Maybe even gotten married, and he didn't want to think about that either. Instead, he concentrated on taunting Meredith with the fact that he had an X-Wing and she didn't. They'd both gotten Star Wars figures for Christmas, and he let her Luke fly it sometimes, if she asked nicely. A lot of times her idea of asking nicely was arguing that since Han Solo didn't fly the X-Wing in the movie, she should get to play with it more, since she had Luke. Sometimes it was easiest just to give in. In May, he'd been at the Allens a year, and even with the month or so over the summer he'd been back with his mom, it was still longer than he'd been anywhere else. He didn't want it to feel like home. Home didn't mean having his own room. It didn't mean eight other people at the dinner table, and the same school for the whole school year. Except when it did, and then he felt like a traitor for ever thinking it. Home was wherever his mom was. Sometimes it was the back seat of a car when there was no money for a motel room, or a stranger's couch while he tried not to hear what was going on in the bedroom. For one summer, when he was six, it was at his grandparents' house while his mom tried to clean herself up. He thought about his grandparents sometimes, wondered if they knew he was here or if they thought about him at all. He didn't even know their names or if they lived here in Colorado or somewhere else. All he remembered was that it was a long drive. He didn't think about them very often, though, and as time went on he thought about his mom less and less, too. If you ignored the fact that sometimes the kids were different if someone got adopted or someone else's mom showed up, the Allens were almost like a TV family, like Eight is Enough or something, only with seven of them, and John kind of liked it. In seventh grade, the other girls were starting to get boobs. A lot of them wore makeup and had purses, and they liked to huddle together in the corner of the classroom and giggle. Meredith's hair was still cut short, shorter than John's even, and he'd never seen her in a dress. John knew he should like Sandy McKinley, who had bigger boobs than anyone else in their grade, or Jenny Grant, who all the boys said was easy. He knew not to look at other boys in the showers, knew better than to ever even look like he was looking. It didn't take Jimmy Mancini getting the shit kicked out of him to know the boys here had no more love for fucking faggots than Mom's boyfriends had. If Jimmy didn't know that by now, it wasn't John's problem. So he pretended to be interested when someone excitedly showed off their brother's Playboy, and when the rumor started going around that Mr. Hunt, their algebra teacher, was sleeping with one of the ninth-grade boys, John took up a dare to write cocksucker on Mr. Hunt's desk after school. He never got caught, and he never forgot the look on Mr. Hunt's face the next day, like it hurt to smile. if he didn't talk to Meredith much at school. He told himself it was 'cause he saw her at home all the time anyway. He did spend all his time with her, lying flat on his back in the den, listening to her play piano, or cramped up in their secret hideout doing homework and talking about the newest issue of Superman and what it would be like if Beau and Luke Duke teamed up with Ponch and John. "That's the stupidest idea you've ever had," Meredith said, but John still thought it would be pretty cool. Towards the end of the year, they had to write a paper for English, one of the few classes they had together. It was supposed to be a story about your family. John wrote about his dad and said he was a pilot in the Air Force. He said he wanted to be in the Air Force when he grew up, too, which was true, and for all he knew, the part about his dad was true, too. Meredith wrote about the Allens. "What about your real parents?" She was quiet for a long time and then said, "I didn't like them." He didn't mention that she didn't act like she liked the Allens much either, or how happy she'd been last August when Patrick went away to college, but he noticed she didn't mention Patrick at all in her paper. The first time he kissed her was just after he turned 14. He didn't think about it beforehand, didn't even mean to do it, not then, anyway. One minute they were lying on his bed reading, and the next he was on top of her, their mouths pressed together, and his dick suddenly hard against her thigh. The door was open, and the house was full of people, and it didn't matter. Meredith's mouth opened, and he thrust his tongue in, sloppy and wet, and it took him far too long to realize she was completely still under him. When he opened his eyes, she was crying. He'd never seen her cry before, never seen her so quiet. He jerked away, sat up, and turned his back to her and said, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I thought..." "I told you, I told you," she said, almost too low to hear. "I'm a boy." "I know," he said, but she was already gone. It wasn't like their usual fights. She didn't stop talking to him. She asked him to pass the potatoes and if he'd done his homework, and whether or not he wanted to go to the library tomorrow if it was still snowing. She walked to school with him and talked about what was on TV last night and asked if he was looking forward to the Super Bowl, which was not only a stupid question, but also probably the first time he'd ever heard her voluntarily bring up football. He let her talk because he didn't know what to say, and for days and weeks and months after that it felt like she never shut up. He let her talk because he was afraid the alternative was her pretending he didn't exist. He kept thinking about it, though. He couldn't not. He thought about kissing her, about touching her. He knew she didn't have a dick for real, but thought of what it would be like to give her a blowjob. It wasn't like thinking about girls at all. He'd tried thinking about boobs and pretty girls when he jerked off, but he might as well have been thinking about what was for dinner. They were walking to school when he said it. Gretchen and Andrew had already turned down the street to the elementary school, and it was just him and Meredith. She was talking, but he didn't even know what about. He just walked with his hands shoved in his pockets and looked down at the ground and waited for her to pause for breath, and then he said, "I like boys." "Huh?" "I don't like girls." She walked a little faster, and even though he looked up, he couldn't see her face. He thought maybe she said, "Oh." "Mare," he said, jogging a few steps to catch up with her. "I don't like that name." "What?" "Rodney." "What?" "I like the name Rodney." She turned and looked at him then, thin lips set in a line, like she expected him to argue. Her bangs fell into her eyes. She looked more like a Rodney than a Meredith. He said, "Me too." She was the one who came up with the idea. Rodney was. He. It was hard to get used to that, especially when everyone else still called Rodney Meredith, and it's not like John could call him that when anyone else was around. Maybe that was why it was so easy to say yes when Rodney said they should run away. Or maybe he'd just been in one place too long. John liked the Allens all right, but the only one he'd miss if he had to leave was Rodney. And Rodney was coming with him. "I want to go to L.A., Rodney said. "Or maybe San Francisco. San Francisco has a lot of gays, but it's sunny all the time in L.A., and there's probably a lot of gays there, too." "Either one's fine by me." John squinted up at the narrow strip of sky between the garage and the wall. Their secret hideout was just wide enough for him and Rodney to lie side by side on their backs, without quite touching. He wanted to kiss Rodney. He was getting a boner thinking about it, and he rolled up into a sitting position, drawing his knees up and hoping Rodney hadn't noticed. "I like," his voice cracked. "Sunny sounds good." On the last day of school, they filled their backpacks with clothes and food instead of books. Not that they really needed books today, but John had come up with the idea of saying they had to clean out their lockers if anyone asked. Rodney'd sneaked down to the kitchen in the middle of the night and gotten some stuff, apples and Twinkies and bologna sandwiches he'd forgotten to put any mustard or mayo on. John felt kind of bad about it, but he took $20 from Martha's purse and another 10 from Travis's room. It got them tickets on the Greyhound to Denver, with enough left over that Rodney didn't totally panic. John smiled at the bus driver and said they were going to visit cousins for the summer. "Your brother doesn't look too happy about it," the driver said. "Yeah, he gets homesick." Rodney punched him on the shoulder, but he was grinning. "I do not." The driver smiled. "No roughhousing on my bus now." "Yes, sir," John said, and gave Rodney a push down the aisle. They flopped into a pair of seats at the very back, and Rodney whispered, "He thought I was your brother." "I know. I'm not." "I know." Rodney beamed. "He thought." "I know." John laughed, grabbed him around the neck, and gave him a noogie. "Shut up, jeez." "No roughhousing," Rodney squawked, and John let go. He smiled at the old lady, who turned back to look at them, and she smiled back. The bus would be gone before school was even out. They would be in Denver. He tried not to think about after that. The cold seeped through the knees of John's jeans as he unzipped the guy's pants. The stall stunk of piss, but at least the floor wasn't wet. The guy's hands fluttered around John's head like he didn't know where to put them, eventually settling on John's shoulders. It was easier than John remembered. His mouth was bigger. He wasn't crying. He even managed to smile at the guy afterwards. The 10 in his hand felt soft and worn. They ate at McDonald's to celebrate their first night away from home, and Rodney didn't ask where the money came from. It took a while to find a motel they could afford. It took longer still to find one that didn't insist on seeing the dad John said was waiting in the car. There was only the one bed. John was going to tell the guy they had sleeping bags, if he'd asked. But he hadn't. Rodney kicked off his shoes and pulled down his jeans. He was wearing a pair of John's underwear, the front hanging loose and empty. Before John could say anything, she climbed into bed, curled up on her side, and pulled the covers up around her neck. "Rodney, I'm tired." "Yeah, me too. I just..." John tugged at the hem of his T-shirt, wishing it would magically grow longer to hide his boner. "Gotta pee." He jerked off quickly in the bathroom, then stripped down to his underwear and crawled into bed next to Rodney. He had to get up again to turn off the light. It was hard to sleep far enough away and still have any covers. He thought of suggesting they split them up, but Rodney was pretending to be asleep already. Rodney moved around a lot when he finally did fall asleep. He kept getting his cold feet on John's legs. The rest of him was warm. John had to get up 3 times to go jerk off. He woke up in the morning with the covers kicked mostly off and Rodney wrapped around him. Resting one hand on Rodney's bony hip, John squirmed around and kissed him, and Rodney woke with a start. Sorry, John breathed. "Can I?" Rodney reached down between them, wrapped his hand around John's dick. John's hips jerked, and he pushed into Rodney's hand. "Rodney," He didn't know where he was allowed to touch. Rodney's hip seemed to be okay. Kissing him seemed to be okay, too, when he tried that. John wanted to feel him without clothes on, but he couldn't ask. He was afraid to say anything that might make Rodney stop touching him like this. And then Rodney moved a little, wrapped one leg around John's, and started rubbing his crotch against John's thigh. He was so warm there, burning up, and his hand was warm, too. It was over too quickly. But they did it again. They stayed in Denver for a month. It wasn't a bad city, but it was close to home. Not their home anymore, close to the Allens. They fought over where to go next, west to Grand Junction, or south down to New Mexico. "We can't be this far north when it gets cold," Rodney said, waving his arms. "I'm not ready to freeze to death." "It's still summer." "Yeah, and look how long it took us to save up enough money to go anywhere." "Fine," John said, and rolled over on the bed. Rodney sat down next to him and poked him in the kidney. "Why'd you want to go to Grand Junction anyway?" It might be where John's grandparents lived. He didn't even know their names. "I don't." He rolled back over, ran his hand up Rodney's thigh, as Rodney bent down to kiss him. It was easy to think of him as Rodney now. Nobody here knew Meredith. John wasn't sure she'd ever even existed. Before they left for Santa Fe, John bought a postcard of the city. He addressed it to Greg and Martha and wrote, "We're okay, don't worry about us." He thought about the nights there'd been no money for a motel room, and the first time Rodney had come back from the restroom with more money than he'd had going in, and he scrubbed at his eyes with the heel of his hand and added, "Thanks for everything. Love, John." After Santa Fe was Albuquerque, then Flagstaff and Phoenix, and the first thing Rodney did in each new city was find the libraries. John didn't go with him. Instead, he got good at finding places to stay that were cheap and didn't ask questions. They had to be more careful now that the summer was over. Not just the cold, which wasn't here yet, but the cops, too, who took more notice of kids when they were supposed to be in school. John could pass for 16, or 17, maybe. But though Rodney was tall, he was scrawny and baby-faced, and wouldn't fool anyone. John made him stay inside during school hours. John turned 15 in Phoenix, and still they stayed. Money that should have been saved for bus tickets was spent on jackets for both of them, and new jeans and shoes for John, who was growing out of everything. It went to a portable cassette player for Rodney, who then spent even more money on tapes of classical music. John bought a couple ABBA albums. It was Easter before they moved on to San Diego. They arrived in L.A. a full year after they left the Allens. John half drowses, vaguely aware that Rodney isn't in bed with him anymore. The cassette player's playing something classical that he should recognize by now, but it all sounds the same. After a while, he pushes up on one elbow and reaches down to scratch his balls, palms his hand over his half-hard dick on the way back up. Rodney stands in front of the fan, blocking it, and John says, "It's cooler if you take your shirt off." "No, it isn't." The bed creaks as Rodney climbs on top of John. John doesn't let his eyes linger on the slight swell of breasts, but he can feel them when Rodney presses against him. He wants to tell him it's okay, but instead he just worms his hand between them, slips his fingers into Rodney's underwear, and finds him hard and slick already. Rodney rubs against John's fingers, eyes squeezed tightly shut. He kisses back when John kisses him. It's okay. Title: Ring of Fire, Nails Driven Through the Steel, 5,700 words. Author: Busaiko. This story is Stargate Atlantis. It is rated NC-17. This story is a sequel to Kyu Ketsuki Irui's story, Life Sometimes It Washes Over Me, which you should probably read first. It is an AU of an AU and a fanfic of a fanfic. Opening quotation. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. I was told Atlantis would honor tickets from Air Anxion after the takeover, Rodney says, elbows out, rocking on his heels. He is taking up too much space, slowing the queue, and talking too loudly. He likes the feeling of power that comes from anger. It suits him, he thinks. The woman behind the counter looks pissed, but she's not half as pissed as he is. Business class, he shouts, waving the envelope from his travel agent. Economy! He gestures violently at the boarding pass the woman had tried to give him. Four counters down, a group of men in gray maintenance uniforms with the AA logo on the back have been carefully attaching the new Atlantis Air Arrivals Departures board to the wall. Rodney doesn't mind the grumbles from the people behind him. He was there first. But when the men turn, en masse, to watch, he feels their gaze like a prickle on his skin. That's another familiar feeling. Like a choke chain, it's hard to ignore, even after all the years in therapy. Please, he says, quieter. Wouldn't you rather inflict me on other rich assholes than these poor slobs? He jerks his head at the shuffling herd behind him. The magic word works. He gets a good enough seat to Vancouver. He tells the story to Jeannie twice, once in the airport car park, and once over dinner, the censored version, for his nieces. And then he forgets the incident. Forgets until he returns to work and finds in the middle of his stack of callback notices one that says John from Colorado called, giving a home number in the San Francisco area and a work number with Atlantis Air after it in parentheses. Rodney nearly throws up his two-donut breakfast for old time's sake. He puts the slip in his wallet and tries not to think about it for 3 days before he gives up. He can't lie, not even to himself. He calls the work number at 3 on Friday afternoon, figuring it will be easy to make excuses about having plans and things to do, if he needs to get off the phone fast. The phone rings 10 times before it's picked up. An accented, deeply sexy female voice answers, and Rodney's finger is right on the push-down button. He wonders if he's been blacklisted, if she'll hang up on him if he says his name. Finally, in a rush, he blurts out, "My name's Rodney, and I'm calling for John." He feels about 12. 12 was not a good year for him. 12 was when he realized he was going to be betrayed by his body yet again and have to go through puberty and menstruation and breasts, just like a girl. The only good thing about 12 was John. The woman must be pressing the phone against her chest. He can hear a thumping, like a heartbeat, and her voice shouting, followed by muffled banging and cursing. And then, "Hey, Rodney," John says, and Rodney says, "I have to see you right now." And it turns out that they're only about 10 minutes away from each other. 10 minutes and 10 years. Middle quotation. "Well, I know I had it coming, I know I can't be free, but all those people keep a-movin', and that's what tortures me." Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash. Traffic is terrible, the evening rush hour starting early. The airport access exit that John told him to take comes before the long-term car park, which is only a small mercy. He is driving right under the tires of incoming planes. Rodney follows the chain-link canyon to the checkpoint, where his name is indeed on the list. This earns him a fluorescent orange card to display and a baffling set of directions. "Just look for the A's, man," the guard says finally, steepling his hands like the village people. "The A's." Rodney gets lost amongst the hangars and sheds and warehouses, predictably, but right before he needs to get out and kick something, he sees the logo painted on a corrugated metal wall. The two A's lean together, supporting some kind of bizarre sun symbol, which, after all these years in California, doesn't surprise him. The door reads Atlantis Air Technical Operations, and Rodney opens it and goes through without letting himself consciously think. Inside is a chaos of people and huge chunks of airplanes. There's a steel desk to the right of the door, and a tired-looking woman with hair that's a monument to Aquanet looks up at him. he says, and tugs at the hem of his wind cheater. "I'm looking for John." "Of course," she says, blinking and folding her hands on the desktop. "John Meredith?" He's saved from making stupid fish faces at her because John, in his baggy gray overalls, is barreling down on him, grinning like a madman. Rodney attempts to say hi, but it's swept away in a hug so fierce that he swears his feet leave the ground. "Put me down, put me down, put me down," he says, his face full of hair. John gives him one more bone-popping crush and then steps back. "God damn," John says, and slaps Rodney on the shoulder. "I knew it was you when I heard you bitching. You are still an asshole. Look at you." "Look at you," Rodney whips back. "What is it with the hair?" There are other things he wants to say, a universe of questions, but he recognizes that John's smile is a shade too manic and his eyes are too bright. He lets his eyes shift to the woman and back, and John practically jumps. "Elizabeth, this is Rodney McKay. Rodney, Elizabeth Weir, the head of Tech Ops. Rodney..." And John pauses, as if suddenly realizing he doesn't know how to introduce Rodney. Elizabeth crosses her arms and gives him a maternal stare, and John puts his hand back on Rodney's shoulder. "We grew up together," Rodney says, very seriously. "Practically brothers, in a touching, made-for-HBO kind of way." "That's true," John says. "Everyone thought we were brothers." "Oh, yes," Elizabeth says, nodding diplomatically. "I can see the resemblance." They both say, "Hey!" at the same time, and John calls Jinx. It's stupid and juvenile, but it gives Rodney a chance to gain his footing as John and Elizabeth show him around, at least until they start introducing him to the people on John's team. Rodney finds this too weird to be hilarious. "John is a supervisor? It says so right on his name tag. Seriously, he's in charge of making sure airplanes don't drop from the sky like hailstones? Airplanes Rodney has flown on?" He can almost feel a retroactive panic attack coming on. Rodney meets a kid who radiates apple pie wholesomeness and calls John sir. It makes John's eyebrows twitch. There's a man giant in leather and battered safety gear who looks like a metal shop poster child, but it's obvious that he follows John's orders. The woman with the sexy voice who'd answered the phone turns out to be the most intimidating stick welder John Rodney's ever met. Not that he can say he knows many. John shows Rodney the gearbox he's working on and tries to explain the beauty of friction stir welding, and Rodney ignores all the words and enjoys watching John geek out. It loosens something in him to see John happy and challenged. It makes him feel a little less guilty. Elizabeth gently suggests refreshments, and John stops mid-ramble. They are interrupted on their way to the break room when someone named Caldwell calls for John on the PA. John grimaces, makes his apologies, and lopes outside. "John's a real asset," Elizabeth tells him, opening a door and waving Rodney in. She pours him a cup of coffee from an all-day pot. "He was the first employee Air Ancient had from the PIA. He got a lot of hassle from the former head of maintenance, and now he has to prove himself all over again to the Atlantis management." She gives him a bright look. "But we've got a fantastic record now with the CDC IEP. Ford, Dex, Emigan, John's turned these kids around." "What?" Rodney says. "I work in computers. Your acronyms mean nothing to me." "Have a pretzel," Elizabeth says, holding out a bag with sudden obvious awkwardness. She bites her lip. "I think you'll have to talk to John. I shouldn't..." "Which cat did you let out of the bag?" John says, knocking on the open door and then snagging a handful of pretzels. "We were talking about the inmate employability program," Elizabeth says, "and this is one thing that hasn't changed about John. He would have driven any good math teacher crazy because he skips from problem to solution without ever showing the equations that flash through his head. He's calculating now. Rodney does the same, of course. It's why he never said anything when John appeared with the money to carry them through another day. He knew, and John knew, and talking about the process would only be redundant." Rodney feels his posture straighten and his chin go up, and John squares off at him. What passes between them is unspoken, but he hears it anyway. "John would never say," You ran off on me. But of course that's what Rodney did. When he broke down and called Jeanie, when he got in her car, so sick and wanting to die, he'd left John with a few cassette tapes, clothes even Goodwill wouldn't want, stolen library books. John won't say it, but Rodney knows the worst of it is that he left John alone. And what had he thought, that John would be better off? That his life would improve? John hums Folsom Prison Blues under his breath. "Oh, my God," Rodney says, his eyes widening in horror. "You were making license plates, wearing orange." "Jail's not as bad as people say," John says, letting his shoulders slump into casual cool as he leans back against the wall. Rodney gives him a moment and, yes, John hooks a thumb in a belt loop and cants his hips. "You are such a poser," he says, and turns to Elizabeth. "He used to like the bangles, though." "Oh, so did I," she says, and he can just see her walking like an Egyptian. John holds the hardened glare a few more seconds, but Rodney catches him, eyeing Elizabeth's hair, and he just knows that John's having the same mental image. John makes his Alfred E. Newman face, and then skies are blue again. "Prison saved my life," John says. And Rodney thinks, what? "There are good dentists in prison," he adds thoughtfully, as if this isn't a non sequitur. "Got my GID and my certification. Read War and Peace twice." He looks at Rodney and raises an eyebrow significantly. "What is this, Computer Dating 101? I went to university. In my spare time, I designed graphical user interfaces, which I'm sure you don't understand, in my friend Miko's parents' garage until it made more sense to quit school and make money hand over fist. We now employ 30 people. I was on the cover of a magazine. Well, a trade journal." "Cool," John says, and Rodney hides his flush in the coffee mug. "Go on home," Elizabeth says, and John glances up at the wall clock. "I'll punch you out." Leaving, she gives John a pat on the shoulder and a no-nonsense stare. Outside, in the lowering sunlight, John stretches and twists. He's in black jeans now with a black T-shirt. He's still as thin as a teenager, all sharp angles, sharp elbows and knees, sharp chin and nose, even the same ridiculous sharp ears. Rodney's filled out, as Jeanie puts it, but he likes being solid. He likes being anchored in his body now. "So dinner," John says brightly. "Eat out, or we could go to my place and order in pizza. He looks out over the patch of bay showing between the metal buildings. "I live on the beach. Does that work for you?" Third quotation. "Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire." Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash. It turns out that Rodney does live nearby, for a certain quantity of nearby, and he refuses to think about the fact that all this time he's been so close and unknowing. And John draws Rodney a map in case he loses John's car on the way. Rodney wishes that he could, because John drives a crappy blue Chevy Nova which seems to be held together with bumper stickers. There's just enough traffic that he reads each sticker three times over. When they finally pull up in front of John's apartment, the pizza delivery guy is waiting outside, and John is out of his car and already paying, before Rodney even has his doors locked. Rodney expects it to be dismal. After all, he'd always lived in dismal places with John. But the building is more quaint than old, and John's second-floor apartment has high ceilings and charm. From the table at the end of John's balcony, they can see the ocean while they eat. John's drinking Coke, Rodney has beer. They talk about their jobs, and Super Nintendo versus Genesis, and whether the whole Stargate film was completely improbable, Rodney, or worth it for the explosions, John. The conversation fades out when John brings up football, and for a while they simply lean back and digest. It's so normal, so absolutely perfect, that Rodney hates to break the mood. But he doesn't want to taint this new beginning with lies, even, especially, those of omission. "So," he says, and John stops idly scratching his knee and looks at Rodney with suddenly wary eyes. "I was pregnant." John's face slackens with the shock as if he'd been punched. He hadn't expected that, which floods Rodney with warmth. He loves how John has always seemed to skate so easily over the cognitive dissonance of what Rodney was, as if he only saw who Rodney was. "We never," he starts, and then sucks in a breath as if to pull the words back. "You were so sick. Anemia? Depression? Morning sickness?" "Christ," John says, and shoves away from the table. He stands, makes a meaningless gesture in the air, and practically runs inside. Rodney isn't hungry anymore, and he doubts that when John's finished throwing up, he'll want more. He puts the leftovers in the kitchen and washes the dishes. The toilet flushes twice. He's the pictures of co-workers on the mantelpiece when John emerges. "You look terrible," Rodney says. "Sit. Do you want anything?" John shakes his head. He settles into the far end of the sofa, knees pulled up and his arms wrapped around them. "I'm so sorry," Rodney says, hopelessness making the words come out sharp and angry. "I couldn't stand the thought of you knowing, of having to tell you I wanted to die, disappear. I have a sister, stepsister. I only met her once or twice, but I looked her up in the library. I called her, and she drove down to me that day, from Nevada, nonstop." He shuts his mouth, holding back the babble. "I'm not a girl," he'd said on the library steps, where he'd asked her to meet him, looking down at her, hugging himself into his jacket. "I'm a boy, I swear." Jeanie'd stared up at him, her mouth the same unhappy tilt as his own. "Fine, God. I always wanted an older brother." She'd been his voice the next 6 months, standing between him and the doctors and the lawyers and strangers with prurient eyes. She was a genius. She'd made the name McKay mean something in top-secret research circles, and she made it clear that he was entitled to use her reputation. She fed him computers and Casio keyboards and calculus, and after the baby was adopted away, and where, he didn't ever want to know, she used the McKay privilege and her government connections to get him into school and onto hormones. He still feels sorry about dropping out, for her sake, but she sends him challenging contracts anyway. "I thought you were dead," John says. He looks so tired, his eyes old, his hair drying in ridges where he must have run wet fingers through. I thought... He's not really looking at Rodney. He's staring past him, out the balcony door at the sky purpling over the ocean. "I've got the virus," he says. "Christ, I thought I'd killed you." That is so much worse than Rodney could have imagined this conversation going, that he moves instantaneously. He has his arms around the hard, curled-up ball of John and rocks him, saying stupid things. It takes a while for the sharp points of John's shoulders to drop, and several long breaths later, John's hand comes up and covers Rodney's. His fingers move over Rodney's, exploring, touching each blunt-cut nail, rubbing the hair on each knuckle. He turns Rodney's hand over and traces the lines. "I tried not to think about you," Rodney says, very, very fast. "I wanted to find you after. I looked, I did, I had to have therapy, you know." With his free hand, he gestured at the changes only John would know to see. "They told me to put it behind me, to move on. And it was easier to be a coward." "Hey," John says, "I don't think it was ever easy for you. I think you are brave, are brave." He's touching higher, stroking the hair on Rodney's arm so that it curls upright, offended. "There wasn't a John Shepherd to find, anyway. I was arrested on my fake ID, so my name kinda changed. It was the only thing of yours I still had, so I kept it." Rodney snorts, and John finally looks up at him. "I lost the name as soon as Jeanie got custody." "How uncool," John says. "I got a reject name. I should have gone with Bond." "You are such a smartass," Rodney says. He moves one hand to John's cheek, tilts his head, catches John's eye, and kisses him. It could go one of two ways, he thinks. If it's weird, he'll call it closure. And if it's not, he wants John to see who he is now. The way it goes is that John uncoils under the kiss. They kiss slowly, mouth against mouth, careful with each other, and John comes out of his huddle. His hands stretch up, mapping arms and shoulders and taking broad handfuls of Rodney's back. Gaining forward momentum, he nudges Rodney back until Rodney is lying on the sofa with John over him, holding him, kissing him like a benediction. John ducks his head down, burying his face in Rodney's neck, and he's shaking. Rodney holds him, but he's got one pointy knee in his hip, and John's bracing a foot on the floor, and it's just not comfortable. He needs to give John comfort, and even though John'd probably shave his head before admitting it, comfort is what John needs. "Bedroom," he says, against the back of John's neck. He pushes. "Up." John won't meet his eyes, not in the corridor, not in the bedroom. Rodney takes off his shoes and socks, watching out of the corner of his eye as John mirrors him. He undoes his belt, coils it, and sets it on his shoes, and then crosses his arms to pull his shirt over his head in one smooth motion. When he tugs his wrists free of the cuffs, John's there, right there, reaching up to comb through his ruffled hair. "If it falls out tomorrow, I'm blaming you," he says, and grabs a handful of the hem of John's shirt, tugging up impatiently. John looks down. He's looking down and looking at Rodney. Rodney doesn't need to hide his chest. He likes his chest. But he feels the awareness that this is the first time John's seen him without a shirt. It feels significant. It feels ridiculous that John's the one being shy now. He has John's shirt pulled off halfway before John helps out, and then he backs John up to the bed and makes him lie down so that he can stretch out alongside him. He's weirdly okay about John looking at him, all of him. He's had a few lovers since the change, but he usually is sharp about directing them away from the scars and back to the fun things like nibbles. Admittedly, John's fairly entranced by his nibbles. Rodney could never let him touch them before, but now there's flat muscle, more or less, underneath, and a pleasing covering of chest hair. John touches him everywhere, with a look like wonder. Rodney touches John back, but it's hard. He doesn't want it to feel like pity. There's a bad burn scar across his stomach and another on the back of his shoulder. He has a tattoo of a transforming robot on his bicep that he refuses to explain, and really there simply can't be a good explanation for it. At some point, Rodney gets his arm under John's head. There is kissing, lazy and slow, and then there is touching, and then John slumps lax and heavy against him, his breath humid against Rodney's chest. Rodney looks at John, looks at the ceiling, and wonders why he thinks it is so funny that John's fallen asleep on him when he, well, he'd been planning on getting laid. He waits until he thinks John won't wake up before getting out of bed. He throws the cotton blanket over John and wanders down to his car for his stuff. With his laptop on the kitchen table and the spiral cord of John's telephone stretched nearly straight, he checks with his project leaders and arranges meetings for the next week. Shutting the computer down, he dials his doctor at home. In between the grumbles, "You had better be dying this time, goddammit," Beckett is sympathetic and helpful, promising to leave information for Rodney at the reception desk during office hours. You do know what office hours are, don't you? Before ringing off, he says, "I'm sorry, Rodney." It's late enough by now for Rodney to actually feel sleepy, so he rummages in John's bathroom for a spare toothbrush. He finds one and doesn't think twice about opening it. John fell asleep on him. Rodney is owed a toothbrush. He washes his face and uses John's towel. In the bedroom, he takes off his trousers and, after a moment of indecision, leaves his briefs on but removes his dick because he figures he can make himself at home. John fell asleep. Rodney is owed. He puts the light out and crawls under the blanket with John, who generates a remarkable amount of heat. He kisses John good night. John doesn't move at all. But when Rodney wakes up, John's hair is in his face, John's head is on his shoulder, and John's hand is curled over his heart. It's sweet and domestic, and not a little unnerving. Rodney eases out of bed again, looking for coffee. There is no coffee, which is simply wrong. Rodney grabs John's newspaper and goes back to bed with the crossword for distraction, because when it is this quiet, he can't help but think, and there are things he doesn't want to think about. He had felt awkward being introduced around John's workplace, as if he should have somehow justified his presence or his absence. But he had been welcomed for John's sake, and it's unnerving to realize now that they must consider him the prodigal, home to meet the family, or the dysfunctional equivalent there anyway. He is fairly sure he didn't make a good first impression. He rarely does. The room faces southeast, and bright sunlight pours through the blinds. Rodney shouldn't feel as cold as he does. He pulls over more of the blanket and tucks it around his feet as he uncaps the pen and tries to remember who the son of Poseidon and Medusa was. He is halfway through the downs when he feels the bed shift, and he looks down to see John blinking up at him, frown lines between his eyebrows. Rodney's had his own years, when no amount of sleep takes the edge off the tiredness. He knows that look. "If it isn't Sleeping Beauty," he says, and John makes a half-hearted grab for the newspaper. "Oh, no, I was left to fend for myself. You owe me," he says, and pokes John in the shoulder. "Bite me," John says, and stretches, hands against the wall and back arching with a pop. He kicks 1-2, and the blanket disappears over the end of the bed. "You're still here." He puts his hand on Rodney's knee as if making sure. "Sukasa mikasa," Rodney says, and puts the newspaper on the nightstand. He scooches down, propping his head on his hand. "I used your phone, but mostly for local calls. I'm recharging my computer, in your kitchen, and I took one of your toothbrushes. I was going to drink up all your coffee, but you seem to have beaten me to it." "Wow," John says, yawning and displaying all of his lovely prison dental work. "I am such a generous host when I'm dead to the world." He pokes Rodney's stomach, thoughtfully. "Computers, huh? Smarter than 9/10 of the people you'll ever meet," Rodney says, trying to evade the poke and not roll off the bed. He jabs John back on the scar that slants over his shoulder. "Welding, huh?" John grins. "That's actually from a barbecue mishap. This one," he rubs his stomach, "was from welding." "I get that you're good at what you do," Rodney says, walking his fingers along the scar. "But I thought you wanted to be a pilot." He detours, circling around John's navel. John wiggles and tries to slap Rodney's hand away. "Never even flown in a plane," he says, grabbing Rodney's hand and trapping it between his thighs. "Never?" Rodney says. "What, they don't give you free tickets?" "No place I ever wanted to go," John says lazily. Rodney thinks about the desert sky over Jeannie's house, when they lived outside Area 51, about Vancouver bedecked in baskets of flowers. He thinks about the time he took Jeannie's children to Cape Canaveral to see the shuttle launch, and about the 6 months he spent living in Meyrin, the alpine capital of computer geekdom. "Never," he repeats stupidly, and John sighs. "Don't get me started on nevers," John says, and his tone says that he is not joking any more. "Or some days," John adds, as Rodney opens his mouth. "A lot of things are never going to happen some day. I don't need anyone to make me regret that." "I'm selfish," Rodney says, sliding his hand up. He rubs the heel of his hand over the front of John's boxers and smiles when John's dick swells. "I promise I won't try and drive, but I can't be a bystander." "Great," John says, shifting and pushing into the touch. "Just what I wanted, a backseat driver." "Not today. I left my dick for that at home," Rodney says, and John rolls on top of him, arching so that their chests rub together as he kisses Rodney. "You're giving me beard burn," John says, pulling back and licking his lips. "I could shave," Rodney says quickly, before he realizes John's not annoyed he's having him on. John looks happy, and he licks his way down Rodney's throat. "Sure, Rodney, you could shave," he says, and does something with his tongue that makes a huge sandpapery noise on Rodney's chin. Oh, ow. His hips are moving slowly down against Rodney, a lazy grind. "My stubble's turning you on. That's beyond kinky and into weird." "You're turning me on," John says, and kisses Rodney again. "It turns me on to see you in a body that we both think is sexy." He slides one hand down, rests it for a moment over Rodney's stomach, and then runs his fingers under the elastic band of Rodney's briefs. Can I? I don't, Rodney blurts out, and John shuts him up with his mouth and his fingers. You've always been kind of genitally challenged, he says, while Rodney is gasping with that wonderful rare pleasure of letting himself be touched. He lets John blow him, and before he can coordinate enough muscles to reciprocate, John rubs himself off against Rodney's leg. They both lay there, stupid with afterglow, for a few breathless minutes, and then John kisses him hard one more time and rolls off the bed. John takes the first shower, and then makes breakfast, while Rodney takes his. He tells Rodney to borrow any clothes he needs, so Rodney digs out a large-looking pair of cut-off sweatpants and a welder's like-it-hot T-shirt. The pants turn out to be very snug around his hips, but he's packing, and when he looks in the mirror, he likes what he sees. When he goes into the kitchen to make vague, useless, helping-out gestures, John ogles him, nearly filleting his hand with a grapefruit knife. Pleased, Rodney doesn't complain about the grapefruit, or the 7-grain toast, or even, God help him, the bran flakes. The weird herbal tea, on the other hand, is well worthy of his scorn. John sips and smirks and sips. "Don't you have drugs or something to take?" Rodney asks when John starts clearing the table. He grabs the washing-up liquid and makes it clear that he's more than capable of tidying up. "Nah," John says, leaning his butt against the counter and watching Rodney like he's better than football or airplanes or even cool special effects. "I manage okay." Rodney splutters. "Granted, a lot of medicine is voodoo, but it can be worth it, take my word for it." John shrugs. "I appreciate the concern, but you don't know what you're talking about." Rodney rinses the sink and wrings the sponge out hard before setting it on the counter. He can feel his mouth slanting. He knows he looks upset and angry. "I will know what I'm talking about. Just give me a few days. I don't know how many times I have to tell you this, but I'm selfish, and that means I don't want to lose you, not once I've found you again. There are only 4 people I love in this world, and 2 of them are prepubescent girls, and 1 is my sister, so I'm going to hold on to you tight." John takes a deep breath, and suddenly Rodney remembers that maybe they aren't supposed to be having the relationship ground rules conversation. Maybe it's supposed to be the it's been real conversation, the so long, Rodney conversation. "Yeah, okay," John says finally. Rodney erupts into, "I bear my soul to you, and that's all you can say." And John just smiles, chin tucked down, eyes laughing from behind his bangs until Rodney winds down. "Yeah, that works for me because I love you too, all right?" "Like a brother," he qualifies as Rodney reaches out for him. "Or a lover," as he takes Rodney's hand. "Or maybe both. I bear my heart to you and you quote me Matt Groening." Rodney slaps John on the side of the head and John ducks and kisses him. They're both kind of shaky, so it's slow and sweet and promises happiness ever after. And then as my epilogue, the obituaries for the week of February 16, 1996. Marcia Taylor Anderson, 74, a resident of Pacifica, was called home to Jesus February 15th. She was born June 18, 1922. She is survived by a sister, Patricia O'Neill, her daughter, Jennifer Anderson, and her cousins, Tom Wilson and Bernice Sparker. She was preceded in death by her parents, Richard and Sarah Anderson, and her son, Richard A. Richard, a memorial fund is being established in Marcia's name for the American Heart Association. Love never ends, 1 Corinthians. Leroy Delacroix, 54, Oakland, found peace February 14, 1996, in hospice, surrounded by his loving family. Lee was born September 5, 1942, to Malcolm and Patricia Betty Delacroix of San Mateo. He was a graduate of Texas State University. He taught English in the Oakland public school system and is remembered as an inspirational drama coach. Lee is survived by his brothers and sisters-in-law, Anton and Larry Delacroix Lopez, and Troy and Don Delacroix. Friends and students may call at Massey Funeral Home Thursday, 5 to 9 p.m. John Meredith, 29, resident of Pegasus Beach, died suddenly, February 14th, at St. Walburga Hospital of complications due to pneumonia. He is survived by Rodney McKay and Jeannie McKay Miller, and his nieces Madison and Nevada Miller. The family would like to extend their loving gratitude to John's friends and their colleagues for their support. In lieu of flowers, donations are being made in his name to prisoners with AIDS. John, we hope you're flying now. Keiko Shimamoto, 105, Oakland, died February 13 at Westside Nursing Home. She was born January 1, 1895, in Mie Prefecture, Japan, to the late Hidemasa and Tami Matsubayashi. She married the late Professor Masayoshi Shimamoto in 1920 in Nagoya City and emigrated in 1925 with her children Sachiko Shimamoto Okagura and Makoto Shimamura. The family moved back to San Francisco after the war. Keiko was a receptionist at the California Cheese Board for 32 years. She was an avid tennis player and enjoyed sea kayaking. She is survived by her children, 5 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held at the Bayside Buddhist Center Saturday at 2 p.m.